It's bonus material time again on the Cinematologist podcast. Welcome, everyone. Down the line, of course, is my good friend Neil Fox. How are you doing this afternoon, Neil?
I'm doing very well, mate. It's really lovely to talk to you.
Yeah, it's nice to, again, slip in a very quick episode here. Minimal work, you know, which, you know, we're workaholics enough as it is, so it's good to get a quick bit of bonus content in there, which isn't taking up too much time. But how are you doing? What have you been up to?
Working, the usual. We're in the middle of term, so that's been quite busy. But the BFI sent me the Wages of Fear re-release. They've done a lovely 4K restoration, so I've just seen the new Blu-ray of that, which is out now. And we talked about Clouseau a little bit, didn't we, when we did Franju? And I hadn't seen this film in a while, and my goodness,
is it wonderful?
It's absolutely wonderful. So it looks beautiful, you know. You just think it's just so well made, and it's tense, and it takes ages to start. Like, there's so much, it's so slow for the first sort of 30-40 minutes where they're just sort of hanging out in this town, and then once it ramps up, it's absolutely marvelous. And it made me want to watch Sorcerer again as well.
I was just going to ask that. Have they both out at the same time, the restorations?
I think so, yeah. I think the new Blu-ray of Freaking Sorcerer is getting a big push now, and I think it's nicely timed to see the two, because I think they are, although, you know, it is a remake, I think they're very different films, all mining the same kind of material. I think it's going to be really interesting to rewatch Sorcerer now, having just sort of rewatched Wages of Fear. So if you haven't seen Wages of Fear in a while, I definitely recommend this new disc. It looks beautiful, and what a film. So what about yourself?
Well, I'm getting ready for our Antonioni episode on Sunday, so we're going back to the Electric Palace. We're screening La Notte, which is one that I have seen, but years ago. I remember, watching La Ventura and Le Clisse, and then going, you know, later on with Passenger and Zabriskie Point and Blow Up, of course. And I really like Antonioni's films. I like the fact that people don't even think he makes films, you know, proper films in a way. He's very much a polemic filmmaker, or someone who inspires a sort of polemic reaction, I think. So it'd be really fascinating to see what the audience down at the Electric Palace make of it. And yeah, so it should be a good night on Sunday. If you're around the Hastings area, please come and see us.
Great stuff. So you've been out and about for this bonus episode. So what have we got to look forward to in this little bonus?
Well, this is just a very quick chat I had with the co-director of the Brighton Film Festival, Cine City, which starts on Friday. And this is with the director's called Tim Brown, and he works in partnership with the university and Film Hub South East and Screen Archive, along with another professor called Frank Gray. So these are guys that are sort of work in the same building as me in terms of when I go over to Brighton. And yeah, it's just great to sort of catch up with him for 20 minutes, and we sort of discussed a little bit of the history of Brighton Cine City, where it sits in relationship to other film festivals. I mean, it's interesting because I was talking a bit about this to one of my classes in Screen Industries. We were talking about film festivals and what they're for, and how they try to sort of create an identity for themselves and pitch themselves in relationship to other festivals, and what film festival culture is like. So we sort of broach those subjects for a little while, and then get into some of the highlights of the festival, which, you know, it's got very much got this world cinema tagline. So there's a lot of films from all different parts of the world, and I think that the sort of dialogue between local filmmaking in Brighton and filmmakers coming from all over, and having kind of like talk and discussing similar issues around filmmaking, but also around politics, culture, society, all of that kind of stuff. So yeah, it was good to catch up with him and discuss what's coming up in the next few weeks in Brighton.
Yeah, it's a really great interview. Lots of fascinating stuff covered. I really enjoyed it. It was really interesting to listen to him talk about, you know, Cine City in the context of places like Leeds and Cambridge. And you realise that there is this great kind of heritage of regional festivals. And that sounds parochial, but I don't mean it that way. I mean, you know, these really great events which cater for, yeah, kind of hubs of cinephiles and film fans, and just coming and having been to Cine City in the early days, and then just coming back from Cambridge the other week with Wilderness. They feel like important events, and just listening to the program, you think, wow, it's it is important that festivals are there and supported, because they remind you of the rude health that kind of world cinema is in. And I mean world cinema in terms of like literally the breadth of the films out there. So it's great that CineCity's got itself in a position just by sticking in there and kind of taking time to develop its identity to have such a really great, incredible program. So made me jealous that I'm not in Brighton over the next couple of weeks.
It's going to be really good. I'm doing my best to sort of find time, slot screenings in here and there as I'm around. I mean, I teach in Brighton on Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, and like for example, the Hanukkah is on the next Tuesday evening, and it's just after my philosophy on screen class. So I'm trying to persuade my students to just to go straight out of 3 hours of philosophy straight into Hanukkah. I don't know whether they'll be able to manage that, but
sounds as sadistic as Hanukkah himself.
exactly. And then you know the opening screening is the Madonna, Martin McDonagh. His latest film is on Friday, so that should be good fun. And I do want to catch the Battle of the Sexes, of course. You know, the sort of seems to be a tennis themed summer in terms of tennis movies. You know, I don't know whether I ever would have said that, but yes, if you go online to the City Cine website, you can see the kind of stuff that's coming up. So this is my talk with the CineCity Festival co-director Tim Brown. Tim, thanks very much for coming on the podcast on what must be a really busy time, the week before it starts.
It is a bit full on at the moment, but it's nice. Actually, it's really nice to stop and just kind of take stock a bit at the same time.
So absolutely. And this is the 15th year. Have you been involved all that way back?
I have. So myself and Frank Gray from Screen Archive Southeast at the University of Brighton, we set up CineCity. Yeah, 2003 was the first edition, and yeah, that feels like a long time ago. Yeah. It is a long time ago.
Was it quite small back then, right at the beginning?
Yeah, well, the first couple of years, but then actually, because it does ebb and flow and sort of change in size and scale. I think the second or the third year was actually, it was surprisingly large, and we were working also with Cineworld at Brighton Marina. So I think it was a bit like throwing enough mud at the wall and to see what stuck. Yeah. And then actually after, so a smallish first year and then two or three really busy full-on years. And then kind of reined it back a little bit and it just got a bit more focus, because Brighton is obviously a great place to live and work. And there's lots of really dedicated and committed cinephiles and cinema goers. But at the end of the day, it is quite a small city and surrounding area. So compared to other festivals, well, for instance, Leeds Festival, which takes place around the same time as ours, that has a much, much bigger catchment area. Because so many places, you know, are within an hour of Leeds. Whereas Brighton, being on the south coast, obviously there is Hastings and Worthing and Haywardsea, so people do travel for certain events. But so, basically we've sort of kind of focused it and made it hopefully a bit more targeted over the years.
Yeah, in that regard, would you say, I mean, you compared it there to Leeds, would you say that there is a specific kind of identity or ethos you go for in terms of the programming and what you put on? I mean, you know, the timing of it, sort of November time, like it's sort of the back end of a lot of the films that have gone through festivals like Toronto and then London, and then you've got some titles that have been through there. So yeah, has it always been at the same time, and what's your thinking in that sense?
Yeah, it's always been the same time of year, and partly that is based on it is this global, a UK cinema calendar and then a global calendar. So it's taking where we started just thinking, well, where could one position a film festival? Because although there's Brighton Festival, which takes place each May, that's obviously is more geared, I mean, we do curate a film program for Brighton Festival each year, but that is more performing arts festival.
Right.
It's May when everyone goes outdoors,
sure,
and the sunshine. And of course, May is when can happen. So there aren't really any film festivals in the UK that take place in May. So there was, cast my mind back sort of 15 years, there was a lot of discussion and debate about where the festival could go. But you're quite right. I mean, following on, because London Film Festival is the biggest film festival in the UK, and if we were trying to secure certain titles, we basically wouldn't be able to get them until they'd had their UK premiere. So there are a fair few UK premieres dotted through the programme, but some of those, the bigger titles from the more renowned sort of art house directors, whether it's Clive Bernard or Lynn Ramsey or Michael Haneke, you know, as a smaller, you know, we are a smaller regional festival, one has to sort of see what London does. Let them announce their programme and then following in their wake. And it's the same, I think, with, you know, say Leeds Film Festival,
sure,
Cambridge Film Festival, which has moved around the schedule a bit. I used to do some work for Cambridge Film Festival. It used to be in July. And then I think with UK Film Council money, Edinburgh Festival, which used to be in August, moved to June. And that had quite a bad impact on Cambridge Film Festival, because then Edinburgh just before it. And now Cambridge has gone later, was in September. And then they made a decision, I think this year for the first time, to actually follow, or maybe last year, to follow London as well, just so you can deliver more of what your audiences want, which is, you know, people do want those.
Yeah, there's a lot of kind of horse trading in terms of schedules, I would imagine. People looking and assessing where they are and who are they bigger than those, you know, that
exactly,
kind of thing.
Exactly, yeah, there's lots of sort of jockeying for position. I mean, for us, in a way, it's quite simple because we're not an industry-facing festival. It is purely for audiences in Brighton, Hove and surrounding area.
Does that affect the kind of films that you're able to get in terms of, sort of, you know, working with distributors and stuff like that? You know, because I can imagine that if they don't see the potential of a sale on the horizon, they might be a bit funny about where a film will go.
Yeah, I think there are distributors, certainly, where they say, that's it, we're not doing any other UK festivals. That's unusual. Occasionally it happens for one or two reasons. Either the film is really, really good and they just don't want it overexposed before it goes on release, even though they know it would generate brilliant word of mouth. It just sort of can add to an extra specialness or add a sort of cachet, because it, you know, if it might have played in Venice, might play in London Film Festival, but then if it doesn't play Leeds, Cambridge, Brighton or others. Sometimes it happens because they know it's actually, obviously it can go the other way, but they know the reviews and the word of mouth might not be what they were hoping. But I have to say, I mean, generally, I mean, there are advantages to longevity and just being able to survive and keep going. So after 15 years, you know, we have developed a really good working relationship with a wide range of distributors, which is an essential part of what we do. Because I think anyone outside of sort of film exhibition or who isn't so au fait with it, it is a sort of an inexact science, but how we actually source the films, you know, it can be quite complicated. I think sometimes people think we just sort of phone in a list, or, you know, like a Christmas wish list or something. Dear Santa, can we have? But there can be a lot of negotiation and touring and frying. But as I say, we've got a really good relationship with a wide range of distributors, whether that's Studio Canal or Curzon Artificial Eye, Thunderbird, and, you know, the opening night film, Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. That's a 20th Century Fox title. Goes on release, I think it's the 12th of January.
So that's the first film, Martin McDonagh's film, that's on this Friday.
That's right, yeah. Opens the festival this Friday, 6:30 at the Duke York's. Sold out very quickly, I'm pleased to say. But yeah, that's I think really, I mean, 20th Century Fox are obviously a big distributor and they do have a wide range of titles, you know, art house through to more commercial titles. But I think having worked with them quite closely over the years, I mean, Martin McDonagh's last film, Seven Psychopaths, was actually Cine City opening night 5 years ago.
Oh, right.
I think. So we've sort of over the
There's
years.
A history there with that.
Yeah, and it certainly makes things easier, because being able to say to somebody, look, we had one of your titles before as opening night or closing night or whatever, it did really well, it's sold out, or it generated such good word of mouth that when the film goes on release, you know, these people are scrutinising the box office return. So if one can point to it being a commercial as well as a cultural success, that obviously helps enormously next time you go knocking on their door saying, you know, please can we have a film for opening night? And
sure. In a sense, CineCity sort of sits in terms of its organisation, its partnerships, you know, with the university and also with the Film Hub Southeast and with the Screen Archive Southeast. And this year I've seen on the literature, the sort of Brighton Rock anniversary is one of the big, commemorations that's taking place in terms of defining the festival this year. So do you think, is it really important to the festival that there is this strand of the local area, the local filmmakers, local identity that feed into the festival?
Yeah, I think it certainly is. And I mean, Brighton is a very particular place. And every other person I think that I meet is an artist or a filmmaker or a musician of some description. And that is an advantage, I mean, in comparison to other city. I mean, is media very media savvy and a very creative city? So it would be remiss really of us if I mean, obviously our tagline is Adventures in World Cinema, and that for us is the starting point, and it feels the most important part of the festival. It is putting other cultures on screen,
right,
and enabling that kind of cultural exchange. It's just something very special about listening to other languages, seeing other cultures and locations.
So it's a sort of local global crossover type thing.
Yeah, exactly. I think and Brighton, because of the number of creative people who live here, I mean, it's reflected our patrons. We're very lucky to have some really great patrons on board. So Nick Cave's been with us since 2004, I think. Ben Wheatley the last 5 or 6 years. So this local global, I mean, they're not, you know, they're based in Brighton, but they're not, there's nothing local or provincial or parochial about it.
Yeah.
So I think you're right, that local global.
Yeah.
And Brighton, more than most other cities, does have that. I mean, people are well travelled here. They do speak other languages. They are really interested in other cultures. And for someone who's programming films, that's a brilliant start, because you've got an audience who are, you know, automatically engaged, really. And so the local element, we do have the sort of annual showcase of Brighton screenings, which is films that we've selected that have been submitted to the festival through open submission. So we don't charge local filmmakers to submit their films, and then we make a selection that gets screened at Dukes of Comedia and other venues in the city. And then through working, I mean, the partnership at the heart of the festival is University of Brighton and Picture House Cinemas, and that's been there since the beginning. I think because I was working, I had a foot in both camps. That's how these things, these things sort of start.
And the there is also sort of partnerships now with new cinemas or new venues that have come along, like, for example, is the Lewis Depot, then there's the art gallery,
the Towner in Eastbourne.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And it's interesting that you said that earlier on it was in the Marina cinema. So do you think it gives it a different vibe when there's sort of different places in the city you can go to?
Yeah, I think so. And it's really interesting looking back or thinking back how things have changed, because when we started Brighton, it really was the single screen at the Duke of York's, the Gardner Arts Centre, as was then, which was University of Sussex, what is now reopened and renamed as the Attenborough Centre for the Creative Arts, and Cinematheque, which was operating, I think, sort of 3 or 4 nights a week at the old Media Centre, Lighthouse and the Media Centre near the seafront, Ship Street or Middle Street. So that was the sort of venues, I think that first year, it was probably those venues, plus assorted cafes and rooms above pubs that were putting on screenings. And because we've always had an interest in taking moving image and film and artists moving image out of cinema or the gallery. It's sort of, obviously the landscape has changed a lot. I think 5 years ago it was that Picture House opened the 2 screens at Dukes of Comedia. So suddenly there were three three screens to play with in Brighton. We have presented screenings at the Odeon. I think the very first film we did back in 2003 was actually at the Odeon, and we did work with them for a number of years. And yeah, as much as you know, the Cineworld at Brighton Marina. So it's nice that things sort of ebb and flow and change, and things don't get too stuck in certain ways of. And this year it is really exciting with, I mean, it is phenomenal to have a new three screen cinema that's opened in Lewes. So on Brighton's doorstep, I mean, it is possible to get there, and Southern Rail permitting, it's possible to get there 10 minutes on the train. Yeah, and you can be sitting in a bar having a drink. And three screens, I mean, the thing with Brighton, as we know, is it, we are hemmed in between the Downs and the sea. Yeah. And with the best will in the world, you know, new building projects, whether it's art galleries or cinemas, space is at such a premium. And then for this year, for the Towner Art Gallery in Eastbourne to have opened a new venue, which they call Auditorium, which has cinema screenings and talks and special events. So to have three screens in Lewes and a new screen at Towner is, I mean, it is unparalleled.
The options are growing.
Yeah. So we felt it was important to work with them this year. I mean, it stretches us. The festival team is absolutely tiny. I mean, it's a skeleton staff. So in a way, it's kind of madness being heaped upon madness to be working. You know, sometimes it's enough of a challenge working with just within Brighton and Hove, but it feels so significant with these new venues. And we are, everything we do is about working in partnership with, whether it's film distributors, whether it's universities, whether it's cinemas and art galleries and other venues. So it felt like, yeah, we needed to go for it this year and to
So what are your highlights then? What should people be looking out for? I mean, we were discussing a little bit beforehand. I mean, there are films coming through that there are films being shown that have do have that festival pedigree. I suppose like Ruben Östlund's The Square is one of the big ones, the Cannes winner.
Yep, that's right, Palme d'Or winner, and lots of positive reviews of that film. There's so much in there. It's quite difficult for me to say. I think one of the most exciting things about a festival is the way that obviously some of the titles are going on release reasonably soon.
You Were Never Really Here, I think, is one of the Lynn Ramsey films. So this is the sort of Joaquin Phoenix as an assassin. I've heard it described as the art house Taken.
That's quite a good way of, and there's a bit of Taxi Driver in there as so some of the titles are coming out quite soon, but there's others like The Square, which I think from memory is March or April next year. Jeune Femme, which is a lovely film that won the Camera d'Or prize at Cannes, which is the prize for the best debut film. That doesn't get released, go on UK release, until I think it's May next year. So there's lots of things like that where you can see the films, you know, fully 6 months before they go on release, and there's something very exciting about that. Although reviews of these films obviously exist online for other, you know, for major international festivals, they're often, you know, there aren't posters, there isn't artwork, there's no trailer, and there haven't really been many reviews other than generally sort of in the trade press. So it's something they feel very protean, the films at this stage, until they're seen by an audience.
That's right.
And that's, you know, and received opinion, you know, there isn't somebody, you know, telling you must see the new Michael Haneke, because very few people until now, you know, have seen the new Michael Haneke. So there's something lovely about it's not just people not spoiling the ending, and not just people saying you must see this. It's an exciting time to watch films. For particular highlights, I think it's often the films that, I suppose, a title like The Rider, which is one of my favourite films that I'm lucky enough to go to Cannes each year, and I saw that in Cannes earlier this year. It won the Director's Fortnight Prize, which is a sort of a sidebar of the main competition. And I went, the synopsis, it's one of those films you sort of want everybody to see. It is a lovely, lovely film, but because it's by a director, Chloe Zhao, that people probably haven't heard of, it's her second feature, and because it's about kind of cowboy culture, an element of masculinity in crisis, I'm aware that it might potentially put off some people from going to see it, but it is done in such a, it's such a wonderful film. It's quite difficult to describe in words why it works and why it's so special. But for films like that, I'm really sort of urging everyone to see, because the previous film that she made 2 or 3 years ago, Songs My Brothers Taught Me, was a lovely film set in the same area of America, I think Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. That didn't get a UK release. I was very proud, very pleased that we showed that film in the festival. So that was us working with a sales agent rather than a UK distributor, because it didn't have a theatrical release. And then from there, she was able to go on and make The Rider, which has picked up rave reviews, won a Director's Fortnight Award in Cannes. And it comes here, but because no one knows her, no one knows the actors in it, and it's in this sort of fiction documentary blend, and that it's using non-actors to present sort of versions of themselves. But a film like that, and Sicilian Ghost Story, which is a lovely film, they're very easily overlooked as everyone sort of rushes.
Yeah,
of course, people rushed the new Michael Haneke and Lynn Ramsey, but they're the ones that I'm most keen that people see, in a way.
Yeah, there's a few that sort of fit into that world cinema bracket, really. This documentary, The Cinema Travellers, I'm always interested in films about cinema, about this you know, this small company who go around rural India screening films in, you know, sort of pop-up style, and all those questions about what cinema still can do in the digital age is something that fascinates me. And then, of course, there's this film, A Fantastic Woman, set in Chile, about a trans woman dealing with a sort of social and institutional transphobia on the death of her partner. And this has sort of been well received, and you know, I think a lot of people would be interested in seeing that, because obviously there's a strand in the film festival that relates to Brighton's affinity with the LGBTQ.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think there's a lot of titles this year, one way and another. You say Fantastic Woman, which goes on release in March next year, but I think will be one of the bigger art house films of next year. And the director, actually, he's quite prolific. There's another film that he has made that's coming out, I think, a month before Fantastic Woman. But yes, there's a lovely documentary on Armistead Maupin, Untold Tales of Armistead Maupin, which we have. We work with Eyes Wide Open, who are Brighton-based LGBTQ cinema screening organisation, and we're working with them to present Bruce LaBruce's The Misandrists. It's a very diverse programme within, let's say, our starting point is the World Cinema, Adventures in World Cinema tagline and ethos, and then within that.
Just sort of on the big directors, you mentioned Haneke, but also Claire Denis, Let the Sunshine In, with Juliette Binoche, which has got, you know, quite, you know, rave reviews again. I mean, it's funny, I was reading the synopsis, I'll definitely be seeing that. Black comedy about an unfulfilled artist based on a Roland Barthes text. And Juliette Binoche, I'm kind of sold. That's all I needed. And then there's Todd Haynes' Wonderstruck, which again is a festival film that's done the rounds.
And a lovely one for families and younger people.
Yes.
Because it's obviously a lot of the films we're showing are not certificated or classified by the BBFC. So sometimes there are certain titles that unfortunately we have to put a blanket 18 certificate on. But Wonderstruck, we've worked very hard to make sure that the City Council here were able to give it a temporary certificate. And that is a lovely... it's a great film that is appropriate for cinema goers of all ages. So that's one definitely to take your family to.
Absolutely. And then just a couple of other things to finish. So Paddy Constantine has his new film out. I mean, this is interesting because he hasn't made a film for a while. And, you know, Tyrannosaur is just such a powerful piece of work. And this film's about a boxer rebuilding his life, which seems kind of a cliched idea, but so it'd be interesting to see what he does with that, which seems very generic.
And it's got the new Doctor Who in it.
Oh, right.
Jodie Whittaker, really, really good in that lead role. Yes, it's interesting because Paddy Constantine, he's an alumni of the University of Brighton, and he studied photography here many years ago. And I believe his degree show project was a series of portraits of boxers. So boxing has clearly been something that Paddy's always been very interested in and connected with. So
yeah. And then the other thing I was looking at that I really really fancy seeing is this Luanda Kinshasa. So this is Stan Douglas's sort of 70s homage to African influence on the New York music scene. So very funky soundtrack I'm hoping for on that.
Yeah, no, well, you won't be disappointed. We were doing a technical test of that just a couple of days ago, and it is. Yeah, so it's a recreation of a 1970s recording studio, and then he's assembled this great range of musicians, and the film is 6 hours long. You can enter at any point and stay as long as you like,
right.
And it's totally free, and it is just these top-notch musicians jamming. But there's something, they're sort of in 10-minute segments, and there's some piece of technology that I don't fully understand that means it's a constantly revolving loop. So the 10-minute sections, you never... They're never
in the same order.
Exactly.
Oh, right, okay.
And I've seen it. It's the first time it's ever been shown in the cinema in the UK. I was lucky enough to see it at a festival in another country. And I was absolutely hooked. I mean, I just went in. I thought, I'll just pop in, you know, do 10 minutes or so, because one gets so used to, I suppose, how one sees... contemporary moving image in gallery environments, you know, you might stay a few minutes
and then off you go. Yeah,
but this was being able to sit in a comfortable cinema, comfortable seats, great sound, and you know, an hour passed happily, and I'd actually would love just to have stayed there for longer. I went away, got a cup of coffee, did a few other things, and then came back, and because it is over a 6 hour period, you can just pop in, stay an hour, come back an hour later, or you know, there might be some not hardy souls, but some real music lovers who actually stay for the entire thing. 6 hours, which would be... we should come up with some kind of prize or some sort of award for people.
Somebody can review the whole thing from start to finish. Yeah, fantastic. I'm wondering, I'm hoping that's screening in a... You know, when I've got a little bit of a break in between teaching, I'll just go pop in there for an hour or so.
Yeah.
It sounds great. Well, I mean, the programme does look fantastic. I'm actually introducing Daniel Blake, so I'm looking forward to that.
Thank you very much.
No, that's fine. And all the very best. Thanks for talking to us on the podcast.
Pleasure. Thank you, Darian.
It's humble.